And I want to begin the discussion. This is a very important subject right now, and people are beginning to weigh in on it. The whole issue of what you hear about is this issue about a just war and an unjust war. And it seems to me, I read an article last week that the majority of the so-called religious leaders, I'm not talking about the Jewish necessarily, but mainly the Christian, I would think that the overwhelming majority of them are against war, are against this war. That's the sense that I get. And as far as the how the Jews, the Jewish clergy looks at it, I'm not exactly sure. But the article did note that as you tend to get more Orthodox, then the sentiment is more in favor of a war. I think that in general, the whole attitude towards the question of war, in this area as in every other area, Judaism is different. I see no commonality between the Jewish view on war, as I see no commonality in virtually any issue of significance between Judaism and any other religion. And that is to say that even amongst those who say you have to go to war, it's a just war, there's always this element of conflict. In every other religion, there's a certain pacifistic element. And the attitude is that war is evil. Everybody has to start it. Even President Bush was straining to say how reluctant it's last resort, how war is such an inherently evil kind of a thing. And I think that the root of that is not Jewish. That is connected with Christian theology, in which it's essentially a pacifistic type of phenomenon, but sometimes they can't resolve the issue. You have no choice. But they're in a real conflict. On the one hand, they believe that war is evil. On the other hand, they don't want to get killed, so they sort of like have no choice. If you take a look at the Torah, it seems to me that there is a different attitude towards the whole issue of war. It's interesting that Judaism does not have these categories of just war and unjust war. You won't find that in Judaism. That's not the way Judaism views it. In fact, the conduct of a war in certain situations is a mitzvah. Huh, a good deed. It's a great, great mitzvah. I'll read to you from the Rambam in a minute. Also, the whole idea I wrote a few years ago, this whole issue about the Haredi in Israel, about not joining the army, demanding an exemption, with the idea somehow or other that because they learn Torah, that protects the state. And I wrote a response to that, and I started off by saying that all of the great spiritual leaders of Judaism, if you go back to the Torah, essentially virtually all of them were men of war, engaged in war, going back to Avraham Avinu, who fought a war, a tremendous commando raid, in which and that wasn't necessarily a war of self-defense. It was to save his nephew Lot, who had been captured by this mighty coalition. And Yaakov Avinu was prepared to wage war against his brother Esau if need be. And Moshe Rabbeinu slew the Egyptian. And Moshe conducted wars, the first wars. And when the Jews were moving to a position where they could enter into the land. And Yehoshua fought the mighty battles against the seven nations. And you all can read the description of Shmuel, who rebuked Saul for sparing, did not fulfill the mitzvah of killing Amalek, for sparing Agag. And it describes very vividly how he took the sword and he hacked him to bits. This is Samuel, the great prophet. And Devorah, she led the nation in war. And after they defeated Sisera, she coined the famous song and she praised Yael. What did Yael do? Yael trapped Sisera and managed to get him to sleep and took a hammer and put a peg through his head. And she extolled this. So the attitude that comes through from all of this is that there are situations where the conduct of war is a great mitzvah. The Torah commands us to fight a war against Amalek. There's evil forces of Amalek, midor dor, from generation to generation, and nobody is exempt from this. There's no such thing in Judaism as a conscientious objector. If anyone were to say that they can't fight a war because it's contrary to their conscience, they would be that's a situation which is opposed to the Torah. It's a defect in the individual. This is not to glorify war. I'm not glorifying war. But I'll explain to you why it has to be the case. The reason why war is necessary is because of the phenomenon of evil, because evil unfortunately exists in every generation. B'chol dor v'dor, in every generation they arise against us to destroy us. And since evil exists, mankind is faced with the choice. How do you respond to evil? Now, of course, if you can get rid of evil through diplomacy, that's to be preferred, and that's what you try and do. That's what Avraham Avinu tried to do. He tried to convince people, to teach people about the true ideas of how to live their life, and would they accept that? There wouldn't be war. But what do you do with those people that don't accept it and are engaged in the evil practices? What are you supposed to do? That's why, in my opinion, the position of anti-war as a moral position is an immoral position. And the conscientious objector, provided that the war itself, I'm not talking about any war here, obviously. I'll get to the particular. But if the war is a just war and a person is a conscientious objector, that's an immoral position, because what you're saying is that I am prepared to let evil triumph, and by standing by and doing nothing, then you yourself become responsible for the triumph of evil. And the truth of the matter is that we do believe that there will be a time of world peace, that world peace eventually will come, and it'll be brought about through a king, the Messianic king. And lo and behold, what is one of the tests by which we will know that he is the Mashiach will be the fact that he conducts the wars against evil, the war of Gog and Magog. He'll fight the wars of God, Mohammed Hashem. So the individual who's going to be responsible for bringing world peace will be one who has to be capable of engaging in war. So if you can't engage in war, you can't bring about peace. So I'm just trying to show you, again, I'm not glorifying war now. We're not glorifying war. But this whole attitude that in and of itself it's terrible, can't be good, but what can we do? That is not the attitude of Judaism. There is a situation where there is evil, it has to be dealt with, and you have the courage to fight against it, and you fulfill a great mitzvah. I just want to quote to you briefly, the Rambam talks about the state of mind that a Jewish soldier, when he's fighting a war, has to be in. And he says it's prohibited for him to start thinking about his family and to get nervous, because by doing that he's going to endanger the troops. He's got to have his mind completely focused. Yeah, there are laws that pertain to the state of mind of the Jewish soldier. And he says whoever does so, whoever begins to allow himself to get into a mental state of panic, is responsible for the blood of the entire Jewish nation. If he is not valiant, if he does not wage war with all his heart and soul, it is considered as if he shed the blood of the entire people, and so forth. Then he says as follows, in contrast, anyone who fights with his entire heart, without fear, with the intention of sanctifying God's name alone, can be assured that he will find no harm, nor will bad overtake him. He will be granted a proper family in Israel and obtain merit for himself and his children forever. He will also merit eternal life in the world to come. As it states in Samuel, God will certainly make my Lord a faithful house. He's referring to David HaMelech. For my Lord fights the wars of God, and evil will not be found with you. And my Lord's soul will be bound in the bond of life with God. So you see that, it's interesting, position of the Haredi community, that is to say that even though Israel is surrounded by enemies and that they should be exempted from serving the military on the basis of the fact that since they study Torah they defend the nation, in my opinion, has absolutely no foundation whatsoever. David HaMelech, all the great leaders of the Jews were great Talmidei Chachamim, and they studied Torah day and night. And when it came time for battle, they went out and they did battle. Those are the ones who should be doing. That's the sanctification. They're fighting for the correct purpose. And to the contrary, one should have a tremendous respect for all those, unfortunately, we're in a state of war, the Jewish soldiers that go out and do battle. And they're all great heroes. The truth of the only tragic element is that, unfortunately, because of the divide, because I maintain, because Torah is not always being taught properly, and because the example of Torah Jews is not one which is that attractive to many Israelis, so a lot of these soldiers are fighting and not necessarily with the proper kavanos. They're fighting for the Jewish people. They're fighting for the state, but they don't believe that the Jews are a chosen people and that they're fighting for Torah and they're fighting for an even greater purpose. So that's a tragic element to it, but we all have to have a tremendous respect for that. I just wanted to start off with that orientation, that our attitude, again, is not that war is essentially an evil phenomenon, and that this distinction between a just war and an unjust war is not valid from a Jewish point of view. There's a phenomenon of a war of mitzvah, and under the proper circumstances, that war, to participate in that war properly, elevates one to the highest status of the service of God through war, until the time comes when evil will no longer exist in the world. As long as evil exists, we have an obligation to confront it and to fight it and to employ every means to destroy evil. Now I want to go to the criteria of how we would approach a war such as the one that's proposed, the war against Iraq. I'll tell you what the difficulty is, because all the sources talk about the wars that are fought by a Jewish state, under a Jewish government, under a Jewish leadership, and this is America. So that itself is a challenge in this area. Well, what the Torah doesn't really speak about what would be appropriate in terms of wars that are fought by other nations. So that's what we're trying to do. We're not talking about Israel now fighting. Well, we're talking about an American war. What would render an American war as a legitimate war? Or I'll use the term just in this case, war, because we're talking about America. So that was the challenge in preparing for this. So I think, though, that we can resolve. It's possible to resolve it. I don't think it's that difficult. I'm going to be utilizing the categories that do apply to the Jewish state, but ones which I believe are universal, and that the Torah would apply to a situation such as this as well. What constitutes a legitimate war? According to the Torah, there are two kinds of war. When we have a Jewish government, which is headed by a Jewish king, and there's a Sanhedrin, so there are two distinct types of war. One is a milchemet mitzvah, as I just said, a war of mitzvah. The war of mitzvah basically are of two kinds. One was to conduct the war against the seven nations that inhabited the land of Canaan at the time, and to drive them out completely, and then the Jews would inherit the land. And one of the main themes of the early prophets is the criticism of the Jews that they stopped fighting the war and they allowed the nations to sort of make peace with them, and that led to copying their ways, and it led to idolatry, which was the fact that they did not entirely cleanse the land of idolatrous nations was a major cause of the first exile. It's a big, big tragedy. So this type of... To have compassion in the wrong situation is a great evil. Then there's the war against Amalek, which was started by Saul, and he didn't complete the job. It was completed by Shmuel. And Amalek, by the way, is not just historical. As I said, Nazi Germany is Amalek, and the Arabs today who are dedicated to destroying the Jews simply because they can't be a Jewish state, that's Amalek too. There's no difference in my opinion. And it's not just my opinion. I can refer you to the writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Then you have the third category of Mechamas Mitzvah is a defensive war. That is a war of self-defense when you're being attacked by an enemy. The other type of war I'm just going to mention, but we're not going to discuss, it's an optional war. Mechamet Rishut. That would be very, very controversial to discuss, so we'll leave it for a different time. But that's a case where you're not being attacked, where you're not in jeopardy. And it's a different type of phenomenon. It's optional. And there the king is more restrained. In the case of a milchemet mitzvah, an obligatory war, the king does not require the approval, like we have in America, the Senate has to give its approval. The king does not require the approval of the Sanhedrin. If Israel is attacked, then the leader has the power to force the nation to go out and fight. He doesn't need anybody's approval. Certainly doesn't need the approval of the United Nations. But... can you imagine if Israel had to go to the UN to get approval? In the case of a reshut, an optional war, he needs to do it in conjunction with the permission of Sanhedrin. That doesn't apply to Israel today. Israel doesn't have a king. Israel doesn't have a Sanhedrin. Israel doesn't engage in optional wars. The argument, however, is that in the case of attack, self-defense, that's obligatory, and that would not be dependent upon the existence of a king. And even today, the wars that Israel fights are wars of self-defense, and they're wars of mitzvah. Now, what about the issue, this is the big question, the issue of preemption, preemptive attack? As you know, Israel, let's take Israel as the case, has engaged in preemptive war. For example, in 1967, was that a preemptive war? Well, it's not. Theoretically, you could say that, because they were surrounded on three sides by nations, and Nasser, etc., had declared the intention was to destroy Israel and throw every Jew into the sea. So, they were surrounded on three sides, but there was a period of tension, I remember it, and Eshkol was the prime minister. He sounded a bit shaky, but he brought Dayan into the government, and about a day or so before they launched the attack, he said, it's too soon to give up on diplomacy, and it's too late to attack because we've already lost the element of surprise. So the Egyptians and the Syrians, they were all listening, and they believed him. So they let their guard down. The next morning, they attacked the airfields on all sides, and they won a great victory. That was preemption. Of course, the preemption was in conjunction with the fact that you had an enemy who was about to attack. Thank God they preempted. In 1973, however, a lot of controversy about that, they didn't preempt. It's not exactly clear, but there is a possibility that there was a concern about negative public opinion, and they felt confident enough to absorb a first blow, and they did not preempt. And it led to a tremendous tragedy. Fortunately, they were able to pull back from that situation, the crossing of the canal, Eric Sharon, and they were able to salvage what could have been a horrible situation. The war in Lebanon, the invasion of Lebanon, essentially was pretty much preemptive, because it wasn't a situation where they were being faced with an imminent threat of destruction as in 67. There, this is a pretty interesting example. The PLO had ensconced itself in Lebanon, and they were building up, and they were becoming a menace. And I believe the original objective was to go in there and to deal a fatal blow to the PLO. Unfortunately, they were prevented from doing so. Failure of American diplomacy, and they let the PLO escape and regroup in Tunisia. Had they destroyed the PLO at that time, the situation might have been different. However, the question will arise, but is this a just war or an unjust war? Because it wasn't as if the PLO had the ability to destroy Israel. It wasn't as though they were mounting an attack. They were just building up their forces, and they were involved in some terrorist activities, but those terrorist activities itself did not threaten to destroy Israel. So I think that many of these moralists today, and those who are worried about this war, agonizing about the situation in Iraq, probably would have been opposed to that. Israel took tremendous flak. Unfortunately, they became mired down in a Vietnamese-like situation. That's a practical thing. I'm not talking about the practicality of it. But I will tell you, from my opinion, from the standpoint of Torah, from the standpoint of Halacha and Judaism, that would be a Melchemet Mitzvah based upon this principle, Habala Hargecha Hashkem V'Hargav. We do not believe in the concept of an imminent attack. You don't have to have an imminent attack. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. What is the point of self-defense? When the person's on top of you and he's got the knife, then you're allowed to fight back. Of course, by that time you're in that situation, it's not going to really help you too much. Habarlo gechash kemahar go is saying something else. This is where I disagree with all the critics. Imminence. He's not showing us that Saddam Hussein represents an imminent threat to us. Habalar Gecha means you don't need, it's not the principle of imminence, that in a situation where you have someone who's attacking you, then you can fight back. That's not what Judaism is saying. That's not what makes it permitted, the imminence. What makes it permitted is the character of the action you're taking against him. If the character of the action you're taking in destroying somebody else is for the sake of preventing him from hurting you, then that's what makes it justified, even if at that moment he wasn't engaged in the act of attacking you. It goes by the character of the deed. If I'm killing another individual for no purpose, that's murder. You don't have a right to just go out and kill people, obviously. But if the reason I'm going out there is to prevent him from killing me, even though right now he's not involved, he's not able to, he's sleeping right now. Yeah, my enemy is sleeping right now. The Hamas leaders are in bed right now. They're not shooting me. They don't represent an imminent threat to me. Because maybe they're not going to do anything until after Ramadan, which is a month from now. So there's no imminence right now. They're sleeping. Of course, that's when you go in and wipe them out. That's the point, because the character of that action is destroying a wicked person, and you're saving yourself. It goes by the character of the action. The character is to save yourself from attack, because there's no doubt in our minds what this person is doing. That is the principle, and I'll tell you something else. You have an obligation to do it, and if you have the opportunity to do so and you fail to do it, that is one of the greatest sins that you could possibly be involved in. That's another principle that has to be brought to bear. And that is, lo tamod al dam re'echa, do not stand idly by the blood of your brother. And this is another very, very fascinating principle that if the Americans were aware, if they understood the principle of Judaism, they'd be able to work their way out of this kind of a dilemma. Because it's not an issue. It's not an issue merely, do I have a right to do so? There's a very serious issue when historians will look back on the period between, say, 93 and 9/11. When you knew that bin Laden was out there, you knew what his intentions were, and you stood idly by the blood of your brothers. Yes, yes, the history will come out about the failures of intelligence and the political decisions and the lack of will on the part of the administration to fight against this and to let it go. Those who are responsible, who let him continue, who let it go, it's not just a matter that a weakness in terms of politics. They're responsible, they have blood on your hands. If you have an opportunity to save someone and you fail to do so, you become an accomplice. You become the murderer. Whatever he does, anyone that could have assassinated and removed Hitler, and there were attempts in his life, and failed to do so, thereby becomes responsible. That decision renders you responsible. So you don't have, there's no in-between. From a moral point of view, you can't say, well, I'm moral, I'm against war, and he feels... So maybe I'm wrong, but at least I'm not involved in fighting, so my hands are clean. No. There's no moral middle ground. Because if it's an immoral war, if it's an unjust war, then it's evil to pursue it. But if it's a just war, if it's a moral purpose, then it is evil to refrain from it. It is evil to refrain from it. Here I want to make another point, which I think is very, very significant. Again, showing how Judaism differs. Israel now is engaged in preemption all the time. That's what they're doing. Fine, they should do more of it. They just over the weekend got rid of this top Hamas leader. And all this is preemption. Because as I said, these people are not at that moment engaged in killing anybody, but they're planning. So, and then the danger is if they reach the point where they'll be able to carry off their activities. So hashkein v'harko, kill them now. But Israel, I believe, recognizes a distinction which the United States recognizes, I think the whole world recognizes, and I've been arguing against this. They distinguish among terrorist organizations between the military wing and the political wing. Finally, they're dealing with this Ariani, this professor in Florida. That's another scandal. He's been teaching in Florida and so on and so forth, and meanwhile, he's involved in raising money for the terrorists and all of this type of a thing. But then the defense always is, even if you could show that he was connected to the organization, he was involved in helping. You see, what they always do, they set up these charitable aspects of the organization. So Hamas, of course, is not just involved in terrorism and destruction. They're also involved in welfare, in giving to welfare, in helping, and in this and that, and then making sure that the next generation of children will be fed and taken care of so they can grow up to be suicide bombers. So that's basically... That idea, in my opinion, is false. No distinction should be made between any wing of a terrorist organization. And just as a mistake was made with regard to the Nazis after World War II, my opinion was retribution should have been enacted against anyone who was a Nazi, period. By becoming a Nazi, you are a murderer and you are liable to execution. There's no doubt in my mind that if David HaMelech was around, he would not have made any distinction between anyone who was a Nazi. Because when you become a Nazi, you are responsible for everything that organization does, and genocide is its policy. So if you're the one that's licking the envelopes and sending it, whatever activity you're involved in, it all has one purpose, to make this organization operate effectively. Therefore, this absurdity to differentiate between the political wing of an organization and the military wing and say that he's not a terrorist because he was involved in political dissemination is absolutely absurd. I mean, in American law, if you're involved in a conspiracy to rob a bank, if you make the plans, they rob the bank, someone's killed, you're all equally responsible. So what's the difference when it comes to this? Now, on the basis of that, I want to conclude. And if you take a look at the situation in Iraq, the situation that America is facing in Iraq, even though what I've said essentially applies to a Jewish nation, these are universal principles. The principle of self-defense, that you are obligated to fight in terms of self-defense. Preemption, the idea of preemption, that you are not obligated to wait until this person has achieved a situation where he's prepared to attack you, but you have the obligation to hashkem early as possible. And that's exactly what Israel did in 1981 when they bombed the nuclear reactor. That was preemption. And everybody condemned Israel, except now everybody praises Israel. The same is true over here, I believe, on these following grounds. First of all, the United States is fighting a war against terrorism, which is a totally different kind of war than I believe has ever been fought before. It's not a situation like Pearl Harbor. That was a classical situation. They attacked. They were an enemy. We fought back. Simple case of self-defense. The war of terrorism is not that simple because it involves different organizations and they're spread throughout the entire world and you can't track down every particular individual. So therefore the policy, and if you read Netanyahu's book, he elucidates this policy, the doctrine, so to speak, is you have to get to the organizations and to the states that support them. There's no other way to do this. And I believe that once an example is made, and once he's disarmed and the regime change and so on and so forth, I think it will have an impact on all the other states, getting closer to those states which shield and support the terrorists that attack Israel. So Saddam Hussein is a war of self-defense. I think there's three bases over here. First of all, as the president pointed out, of course he represents a threat to the United States. Not directly in the sense that he's about to launch missiles against us, which that would be a situation perhaps like North Korea. We're not talking about North Korea now. But he laid out the case. He's a key player in the war on terrorism. He is the most significant of all of the Arab states. He is the most dangerous. I'm not going to get into the political discussion. That's the decision of the administration. You could argue perhaps that there's a different state that's just as bad as he is. It doesn't make any difference. I'm not arguing the politics. I'm assuming that Bush is correct. That in that region, he is the one who's most involved in the development of the chemical weapons, the anthrax, and so on and so forth, and that he has been in contact. He is the main supporter and leader of all these various, the network of terrorist organizations. There's no question that he has ties to all the terrorist organizations that are fighting against Israel. His ultimate goal is to be the leader of the Arab movement and eventually to, heaven forbid, that his goal is to destroy Israel. So in that sense, that as a result, the United States has decided that terrorism is the threat against us, and we saw that on 9/11. In order to achieve our safety, we have to destroy terrorism, and in order to do so, we have to start taking out those nations that are key players in the war of terrorism, and that's Iraq, so therefore it's self-defense. The other basis would be the connection in terms of the fact that he's clearly aligned, he's the leader of the Arab nations in the movement against Israel. In that sense, he's classified as a rodent. He is someone who must be removed. He's involved in the day-to-day. He's involved in fighting a war, aside from terrorism in general, it's against Israel. So the principle of rodent, I want you to know, is that it's not just the nirdaf. It's not just the one who's being chased after. If someone is chasing after me to kill me, I have a right to kill him. What about the rest of you? You're not being attacked. Ah, the answer is, let me prove to you on another basis. very, very simply. Everybody agrees. All these moralists agree. The anti-war people say, if the people of Iraq rose up and they would throw them over, that would be okay. But why? Well, let's say the people in Iraq waged a war against the Hussein and overthrew them. That would be okay. But why? If it's not just to fight against them, why are they allowed to fight against them? If the people rose up and fought against the United States government, we say that's evil because it's a legitimate government. So if you're telling me that they'd have the right, why would they have the right? Because they're being enslaved and they're being destroyed, so it's legitimate. Well, if it's legitimate for them, it's legitimate for us. Because the obligation to save the one who's being pursued is not just on the victim, the obligation is on everybody else. So therefore, lo tamid al dam re'echa, if my friend is being attacked, then I have an obligation to save him, if necessary, by killing the one who's attacking him. I'm not attacked, I'm safe. I have the obligation to do so. If I fail to do so, I'm in violation of Lotam and Aldam Riach. I'm standing idly by the blood of my brother. So, it doesn't make any sense to say that the people of Iraq have a right to overthrow him because he's destroying them, but we don't have a right to do so. Why? According to Judaism, he is then a rodef. He's a rodef against the people of his own country. He's a rodef against the region, specifically against Israel. And eventually, ultimately, he's a threat to the United States. For all of these reasons, it's not just is it a just war, in my opinion, it's a melchemet mitzvah. It's a war of mitzvah. This is the problem of the world throughout the entire century. Appeasement. We've seen the dangers of appeasement because weak-minded individuals were afraid to step up and take the actions that are more difficult, but the actions which were essential. Does history repeat itself? What's happening today? You go to school and they all tell you the same thing. Those who fail to learn the lesson of history. All these people that learn the so-called, because the greatest bastion of anti-war thinking, of an illogical approach, is really on the campuses today. It's amazing. They teach history and they tell you the same thing. Those who learn the lesson of history. So how come they're not learning the lesson of history? Well, the question is, does history repeat itself? It does and it doesn't. It doesn't repeat itself that Hitler comes back and Goebbels comes back. If the exact same situation came back, so then they'd be big chacham. History repeats itself, but in disguised manner. It's never going to be exactly the same. It's the same idea, though. Conceptually, it's the same thing. And the mistakes of history, they keep repeating themselves. All of the appeasement, all of the stupidity, all of the denial of reality, which led to the tremendous calamity of World War II, until intelligent people, like the Churchill, came along and saw the reality. The same thing is happening all over again. And the same thing has brought us to this pass. Because 9/11 perhaps should not have happened. It should not have happened. Maybe it didn't have to happen. And if the people at the time would have pursued Bin Laden vigorously, and would have taken their responsibilities seriously. Well, now the situation has changed. And now there's a different administration. I'm not going to laud him over the other person. He went through 9/11. He may have been the same way had he been president then. I don't know. That's not relevant. But right now he has decided correctly that we're involved in a war against terrorism. This is a melchemes mitzvah. It's unfortunate that you have France and Germany and these other nations, because this war is going to be beneficial to the entire world if it's conducted successfully. So, for all of these reasons, I come to the conclusion that it's an obligatory phenomenon, and I just want to conclude, then I'll take your questions. I believe that the Jews, of all people, should understand this, should respect this, should be loyal citizens, should fly the flag, should support, not just support the troops, of course we support the troops, but it's going to be so absurd if Jews, who are so vigorous in promoting Israel has a right to defend itself, Israel has a right to incursions, to go into other countries, to remove terrorists, And then when it comes to the United States, we take a completely different position. That puts us in such a terrible light in terms of the United States. It's absurd. And it's wrong. we are obligated, in my opinion, as American citizens, to support the country. And this is a situation where it's a just war. This is a situation where it's going to be removing a terrible cancer, which is the greatest threat to Israel itself. So it's very difficult for me to see how American Jews should be in the forefront, of tremendous moral support for the president, for the government, and for the troops. And I'll tell you one more thing. At this point in time, 6 months ago, you could have had a debate. 6 months ago, if sufficient reasons were brought forward why we shouldn't go to war, whatever, could have had a debate. Political debate, whatever the case is. Today, I only discuss it from the moral point of view. At this point in time, heaven forbid, if the United States, because of any kind of political pressure, should back down from its stance, should turn around and send its troops home, and not having achieved its goal, and he remains in power, and nothing has changed, this will be the greatest victory for the terrorists. This will be the most devastating phenomenon, worse than 9/11, because the truth of the matter is, this is what the world... I'm not among those. Certain rabbinical organizations, not Orthodox, came out. Well, we could go to war, provided we had UN. If we have the UN backing, we have to have it. Where, this idea of UN doesn't come from the Torah. There's no such thing as that. We don't believe in that. The Jewish people stands alone. If it's true, if it's just, if it's right, I don't care if the whole world is against it. If it's wrong, it doesn't matter if you have the whole world on your side. If it's wrong, it's wrong. We don't believe in these ridiculous ideas. World opinion. We need world opinion. We need UN opinion. In my opinion, there's only one opinion that counts in the world today. The opinion of the people of the United States of America. Because that's what it's boiled down to. The United States of America, this is the only country that can do it. Britain can help us out. Israel could help. Israel. The truth of the matter is, the only countries today that are really serious in terms of fighting the war, that can save the world from this cancer, are the United States and Israel. Israel is fighting this battle day to day. We've been there. We're involved. We went in there first. The United States came along because of 9/11. But I'm not talking, of course, the fate of the world is dependent on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, on God. That goes without saying. But I'm talking from a purely practical standpoint. It's French opinion is of no consequence, and German opinion, and European opinion, and I'm telling you, world opinion, it doesn't matter. It's the opinion of the people of the United States of America. Because this is a gift from God. This is the only country which has the capacity. It's a democratic country. Rabbi Feinstein constantly refers to this, how important it is to show respect for the Medina. And he says it's a mitzvah, it's an obligation to participate, to vote, because of the chesed of this Medina. He knows. He was persecuted by the communists in Russia. He's someone who could appreciate freedom. And thank God there's the United States of America that has the power and the ability to prevent these evil primitive forces from taking over and doing more damage. So to the contrary, Jews who take Torah seriously should be grateful. Jews who live in America, recognizing all the support that America has given for the state of Israel. Forget about differences on minor things. I read to you from the news conference. Spontaneously, he said, "When the consequences, what if Saddam were to lob a weapon of mass destruction against Israel?" He said, "The consequences. You're talking to me about money. How much money this war is going to cost?" It seems to me, therefore, that it's not that difficult a call. It's a moral obligation to fight this war. It's a moral obligation. Just as we're 100% behind Israel and its battle against terrorism, so too we must demonstrate the same type of vigor and support for the President of the United States. Thank you, and I'll take questions. Questions being raised that since I've made a case that not only is it acceptable, but that it's a moral ideal, does that mean that this would... remove any possibility of failure, or would this guarantee any kind of success since we're fighting for a good cause? That's a very good question. And as I've said many, many times, all we can do is to seek to direct our actions to the greatest extent possible to be in line with the will of the Creator. As the Rambam has said, that the soldier, if he's fighting, puts all of his heart into it for the sanctification of God, then this is a great mitzvah. However, we can't be assured, in and of itself, we cannot be assured that this is going to guarantee a victory, because we're still governed by the forces of nature. I mean, we don't know. To the extent that we're under divine providence, it's very possible. We can't gauge the extent, let's put it that way. Therefore, we're obligated to act within the laws of nature, and the military planners are very sober and putting together the best plans and so on and so forth. It would seem, on a practical level, that hopefully it will be successful and with a minimal loss of life. Loss of life to Americans, and again, I don't want to imply that we don't regret the loss of life on the other side. The Iraqi citizens, no, that's something else. They're put up in a tragic situation. So I think the president has said he's going to go about it in a manner which hopefully will produce the least loss of life. Yes, to a certain extent we can pray for divine providence, but how much, you know, that doesn't guarantee the success, by the way. It does not guarantee the success, if that's what you're asking.
And if it doesn't,
yeah.
The
question is being raised, if, heaven forbid, it does not work out well, and then things go south, so to speak, and we're not successful, we don't achieve our objective, does this mean that we were wrong in the first place? The answer to that question, in my opinion, is that no. That a person has to operate, is obligated to operate on the basis of their own understanding of the situation to make the best possible decision. And no one ever has, after the fact, I mean, David went out to fight Goliath. It could have been the greatest calamity. Saul was hesitant to send him out there. But after thinking about the situation, analyzing it to the best of his ability, he went forth. He did not know that he would win. One never has that luxury of knowing for sure. So we are obligated to operate in that framework with our faith in God that if we're doing the right thing. If, in fact, afterwards it doesn't work out, we're obligated to analyze what mistakes we may have made. Perhaps we made mistakes. We didn't consider certain things. Perhaps it's a result of divine providence. We don't know. But you can't say that since it didn't work, therefore it was wrong in the first place. I don't believe in that in that theory. For example, here's a case. Lebanon didn't work. But maybe it's because it wasn't carried out properly, maybe because he didn't anticipate the United States and so on and so forth. But the idea of going into Lebanon and uprooting and destroying the PLO at that point in time perhaps was the correct idea, but other things happened. All right, the question is being raised. Where it's a clear cut, where it's imminent, there's no doubt that's simple. You know, Pearl Harbor. But in most cases, it's not that simple. It's more complex. I'll agree with that. However, it's only, in my opinion, like Iraq, and people are saying that they're not a threat, and all the rationalizations for the defenders, the anti-war movement, you shouldn't be affected by this. The real reason they're against it has nothing to do with the arguments that they're using. That's because they have 14 different arguments. And whenever you knock down one argument, they jump to another argument. When a person has 14 different arguments, you know that the argument itself is not the reason. There's an underlying emotion here. Whatever the underlying emotion is, we'll leave that for the time being. In the case of Iraq, what's the doubt? How could you possibly have a doubt about Iraq? This is an evil nation which butchers its own citizens, which invaded another country, Kuwait, who engaged in a war against Iran, where millions, not that Iran is a righteous nation, which lobbed scuds at Israel, which is torturing, the mere fact that he tortures his own people makes him a wicked individual, and it's permitted. It doesn't mean we have to go to war for that reason, but if we're going to war for other reasons, that's an additional factor. You can't allow people like this to exist in a situation where they oppress people, and B, where they're engaged in mischief. Everybody knows that he has weapons of mass destruction. You can't deny that. So you're just denying reality. To say that he's not a threat to us, well, of course, because he's not a few miles off the beach ready to attack. But he does. He has these drones. He has the capability. But that's not the point. There's a terrorist network, and I'll tell you something else. We have to set an example. You have to set an example to the world. The reason why 9/11 took place is because they lost their fear of the United States. They saw how Clinton was reacting. They attacked the coal, they attacked Cobalt Towers. These were very, very serious things. And he lobbed a few bombs or something, just to be Yosef, so to speak, to fulfill his obligation. And they knew that they could get away with it. They could do more and more and more. There comes a time when you've got to, this is part of your self-defense, you've got to set an example. Aside from all the other things I mentioned, it's crucial that they set an example. because other Arab states will take notice. Saudi Arabia, all these governments are very shaky. They support terrorism because the terrorists pressure them. And that same way, in appeasement, they'll pay off. They're engaged in appeasement. And France is engaged in appeasement. And that's it, business as usual. But once Saudi Arabia sees what happened to Iraq because they defied the United States, there's got to be fear in this world. And when Syria sees what happens, then the United States will say, if you continue to support the terrorist organizations, we'll have regime change by you as well. And that's what he should say to the Palestinians. Disarmament and regime change. So, what's the doubt? There's no doubt over here. The United States, look, the CIA, who do you trust in this world? Who do you trust? I trust the United States. I trust the FBI. See, that's the problem. Because we have freedom. So we can write books criticizing the FBI and criticizing the CIA, and you can find out how. So it reaches the point where people think there's no difference between us and them. That's an absurdity. You're living in a democratic country. There's a lot of flaws. And you can show in the Mossad. You can go into Israel and you can show that they had the kind of shtick that they did. Of course, there's corruption everywhere. But corruption within, these two, when we were involved in the war against the communist empire. Oh, so we do, they're not different. Like, it's kind of like the Arabs say. All right, so we have extremists and you have Sharon. Sharon is a hawk. You're telling me that Sharon, you can compare Sharon to it. Sharon is a leader of a democratic country. He has constraints. He's a tough guy. He fits self-defense. He's not a killer. He's not a murderer. He's not out to destroy the world. That's an absurdity. So that people lose their perspective. I trust this government. Is it a perfect government? No. But this is the best situation that we have. This is a democratic country. There's a limit to what the kind of shtick they can get away with. And they're not making this up. This is absurd, the conspiracy phenomenon that Bush made this up because he wants to take over the oil in the Middle East. I mean, you're going to think like that, then there's no point in having any kind of discussion. That's pretty much where the left is. The left is pretty much destroying itself. Questions being raised about the first Gulf War. By the way, you can't criticize the first Gulf War. You do learn an important lesson from that. The big mistake of that war was that it didn't finish the job. And that the opportunity presented itself. And what he should have done was to take... Well, once you're there, and you've gone to war, you've got the forces, you should have completed the job. And that was a very, very serious mistake, something we should learn from. That you can't leave these types of things unfinished. But I do believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that prior to the Gulf War, there was less support. There was less support within the United States in terms of the Senate and so on and so forth. This leaves me, nevertheless, with less support, he went in there, and then 90% approval ratings. So this is what I would advise the president about going to war with one ally, with no allies, this tremendous weight to get more allies. I'll tell you how the world works. The outcome will not depend upon how many people approve. Everybody's going to forget the discussion. If he goes in there, if it's a tremendous success, and then he'll be able to uncover the stores, just like when Israel went to Lebanon, they showed what the PLO had built up, the underground supply, the caches. If he goes in there, and let's hope it goes well, with few casualties and tremendous success, then no one is going to criticize him that, then everybody will be on the side. Oh, yes, that's what I was saying. Because even Hillary Clinton's a brilliant politician. What's up is what she has two. She's leaving a paper trail with two different messages. One would be a pop probe, why support the war. That's the way the Democrats are approaching this, and all of them are pretty much the same way. Nobody's unequivocally out. Even Joe Lieberman, nobody has the guts to come out unequivocally and tell you what he thinks. He's couching it in such a way. No, I'm not against the war, like Daschle. He's very blunt. I'm not against the war, and so why? Well, I'm not favoring because of this particular. So therefore, he has two sets of statements. He'll go back to. Of course, I was saying all along. We got to get rid of Hussein. I mentioned that we can't go to war. We didn't have the support. They said it was too soon. We should have waited. Give the diplomacy a chance. That's how these guys are. Bush, if he's the world loves a winner. If Bush is successful, he'll be the greatest American in history. It's not gonna matter. And I'll tell you something, if you have the entire world behind you, the whole UN behind you, and then all the France is behind you, when you go in and it's a failure, it'll be the biggest defeat. No one's gonna forgive him because he had world opinion. They're gonna blame him because you made the decision. That's the way the world is. The world goes by the outcome, it goes by success. Now, why there's greater sentiment on the campuses and so on and so forth, this is something I can't discuss right now, but it's something people should be very, very concerned about. It's a very serious, the tragedy, the corruption of the American educational system, that the overwhelming majority of people on the campus, the so-called intelligentsia, are so completely distorted, and they're a basic, it's a spiritual problem. Their basic emotional animosity towards the United States itself, in my opinion, comes through. That's part of it, but that's a different analysis.
Some of them are just very heavy.